The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Hello, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition for this week. I'm Chris, and I'm going to be joined by the three J's today. So we have kind of a unique show. I don't know that we've had this many people on the show simultaneously in quite a while. We've done it before, but not often. But I've got Jim, Jake, and Jacob. So just realized as I was getting ready to talk here that I'm the only one without a name that starts with J. So we could be the four J's, but I've changed my name, and I'm not doing that. So we're going to get into a topic related to something we promised you last week. I'm not sure it's going to be exactly what we pitched, which was a positioning for the transitionary period from, working accumulation into retirement, kind of those years leading up to retirement, but not yet retired. And positioning is what we call our particular form of asset allocation to prepare your assets for being used in retirement, and then keeping them properly positioned to utilize effectively throughout retirement. So when we say positioning, if you're not a long-time listener to the show, that's essentially what we're talking about. So Jim is kind of going to lead the trio, I believe, in a discussion of things to consider with positioning of assets in various types of accounts. But I'll leave it to him to take us in the direction exactly he wants to go, because I'm not sure I have full clarity on exactly what we're going to talk about today. So, Jim, maybe you can add a little clarity of exactly where we're going today.
Well, this will be a multi-part EDU show to cover a couple of emails we received. So the two J's, if you will be back probably next week and maybe even the week after. We'll see.
So we're going to be Chris and the three J's for a while?
That's one way of putting it, Chris and the three J's. I like that. It makes it sound like a rock band. Yeah. But I didn't realize I was muted because when you were saying that you'd have to change your name, I had said, well, I could think of a word that begins with J that we could call you, but we'll probably skip that instead. And
so the show's going to be rather confrontational is what you're saying.
I kind of like Chris and the three J's. It makes it sound like a rock band. Yeah. But yeah, so for the next at least two shows, maybe three, we're going to take a deeper dive, folks. We received two questions that pertain specifically to positioning. How do we position across multiple account styles, which is where we're going to go today? I'll read the question in a minute, but the listener wanted to say, hey, I got a Roth. I got a traditional IRA and I got a brokerage account. Otherwise, what we normally call always taxable, which is an IRA, maybe taxable, which is a brokerage account, and never taxable, which is a Roth. How does he position across account types? Then we received an email from somebody saying, hey, you know, I appreciate you talking about positioning, but what about those of us In the transitional phase of retirement, they are not accumulators anymore, but they're not distributors. They're not distributing from their portfolio yet, but they're not necessarily accumulating. In other words, they're probably about 4 or 5 years from retirement, which is the sweet spot for doing a retirement analysis similar to the way we project retirement. And we'll talk about this next week. And Chris has often said that our approach to retirement planning is really not good for somebody in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and even 50s to use as a projection tool. There's other tools that are better. Our approach to retirement planning, and ergo our approach to asset positioning, is best suited for when you're about 4 or 5 years from retirement. But concurrent with that, when you're about 4 to 5 years from retirement, you're in what we call in the office. If I walked into Jacob's office and said something to the effect of, how is this new client? What is their situation like? If he said, oh, they're a Venn diagram client, I know instantly what he's talking about. As he's trying to put their portfolio allocation together, he's telling me, they're just like a Venn diagram of two circles that overlap. They are in the situation. They're the, what do you actually call, Chris, the part that overlaps? Is that the Venn diagram itself? Is that Venn?
No, I think it's, isn't Venn the person's name that came up with it?
I don't know, but the actual overlap part, yeah, where accumulation and decumulation overlap, that part is what we call the Venn diagram. This next question that we'll get to is someone specifically asking about that. The reason, again, that I'm sharing this is to let both these listeners know I did receive your email. I think they're wonderful because these questions, I wouldn't say are, they're not twins, but they're definitely kissing cousins. They're related, that we'll just do them all in a series of shows. Knowing how Chris goes on and on and on and on ad nauseum, it could very well run 3 shows. So that's why I told everybody we're going to reserve at least 2, maybe 3 shows for this. Okay, long way to say, welcome Jake and welcome Jacob. I'm going to screw up your names. Let's just get that out of the blue right now. Lord knows who I'm going to call what.
Get it out of the blue.
Say what?
Get them out of the blue.
Get them out of the blue. What are you talking about?
Get that out of the blue. Get that out of the way, maybe?
No, it's get there. Did I mess up again? Another euphemism?
I was just trying to make sure I understood what you were saying.
I'm saying it's you.
Get it out of the way? That you're going to mess up their name?
I hate when you do this. I'm on a roll. And
well, I just didn't want everyone. I was very confused by the blue part. I didn't know what I missed. So I was trying to clarify it for our listeners. But
Jake and Jacob, keeping in mind who signs your paychecks, did you understand what I said?
He was saying out of the blue that Jake and Jacob are here just to add to the confusion. So I think that was it.
Oh, I thought it was.
See, Chris?
I thought it was related to not getting your names correct.
It was all part of the plan.
I understand.
We planned this.
Got it.
Thank you, Jake and Jacob. You will see a very nice raise in your pay. Mm. See how that works, Chris?
Yes. It's fabulous.
Great. That was easy.
Yeah, so easy.
That was easy. That's right. All righty. But anyways, welcome, Jake and Jacob. Why don't you take a second to introduce yourself to the listeners in case people don't know your specific area of expertise at the firm and just a little bit about yourselves.
I'll jump in there, Jacob. This is Jake. Yeah. Been on here a few times and primarily work with on the retirement planning side, but also the tax planning and tax preparation side of Jim's retirement firm. So happy to help provide any context that I can today.
And your professional designations?
I am an enrolled agent, which just gives me an IRS designation to be able to prepare tax returns as well as represent clients on behalf or represent in front of the IRS on clients' behalf if needed. And in a few short weeks, I will finally have fulfilled my experience requirement for the Certified Financial Planner designation. So a few weeks away.
Wow, 3 years came by fast, didn't it?
Yeah.
For those who don't know, when you pass the CFP exam, like Jake did 3 years ago, you have to actually have 3 years' experience before you can call yourself a CFP. So congratulations, Jake. And then Jacob, a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, I'm Jacob. I've, you know, recently been on the podcast, I guess, if you listened to the last couple of episodes. But, you know, if you didn't listen to those, I'm one of the original juniors, as Jim would say, I think, as he refers to me on this. Kind of, you know, mostly involved with alongside Jim on kind of the, you know, the asset management, kind of the positioning side of things. Obviously, you know, we all kind of work as a team, so we're all kind of, you know, involved in the bits and pieces of everything, but definitely more focused on kind of the asset management, the positioning side of things. So if you're an existing client, or if you've reached out to kind of speak with us on that end of things, most likely, you know, over the last couple of years, you probably have spoken with me at some point or another. Was originally one of Chris's students in the financial planning program at Colorado State University. That's how I got introduced to Chris and Jim and the firm. And so, yeah, kind of been, you know, with them for the last, my gosh, coming up on probably, you know, 5-6 years here. I am also a CFP as of the last couple of years. So yeah, that's where I would kind of fit in on things.
Perfect. Anything you want to add, Chris?
No.
All right. Everybody should know who Chris and I are. So that should hopefully suffice. Good introduction. So let's jump into the first email question before we take a few deep dives into it. So this one came in a couple weeks ago, and it begins. You talk about positioning, and I am 2 years from retirement. So he is in that transitional Venn diagram phase, folks, but this isn't the Venn diagram question. I am trying to figure out how to position at least the first few years into retirement. What I need support on is how you position across multiple accounts. I think I have similar setups with a Roth, a traditional IRA, a brokerage account, and a 401k. In short, though, listeners, he has an always taxable, a maybe taxable, and a never taxable. Technically speaking, he has two never taxable, but he has across account types. He has all three account types, at least how we look at them here at our firm. So he continues. But I still find it difficult to assign and position dollars in each account and how much I should have in each account. Do I need to figure out how much I'll spend from each account type every year and then figure out the exact position at that point? This seems very complicated and would involve some degree of tax planning years out into the future. Do you have recommendations on how to do this? I think everybody listening, and I mean the Chris and J&J, I think you'll agree this man is looking at things correctly, but missing a few key concepts that we utilize in the office. He is definitely correct, and Jake, you can opine in a second on this, and Chris as well, because Chris and Jake work closely together as they start projecting a retirement analysis. And we're going to assume that this gentleman perhaps has already done a retirement analysis, whether it's one that mimics our secure retirement income process, utilizing the fund number approach to retirement planning, or if he's using the safe withdrawal rate or a guardrail approach or a ceiling and floor approach, whatever approach he's doing, we're going to assume he's already made some long-term projections. One of the things that we can do with a long-term projection is draw some conclusions about what might happen from a tax perspective throughout his retirement. However, as I often say, that and 50 cents won't buy you a cup of tea in China because taxes change constantly. Don't believe me? I guarantee you by the end of this year, they will have changed dramatically There's no disputing that. The current administration made it clear they're going to have yet another tax bill coming out. This after two Secure Acts came out under the previous administration. And prior to that, a massive tax with the first Trump administration. And prior to that, under the Obama administration, more tax changes. They happen constantly. So that does carry, as he rightly pointed out, almost an exasperation, but he is correct that, yes, you can have some long-term projections, but you also have to look at things on an annual basis as well, at least through RMDs. Anything you and Chris want to add, Jacob, Jake, to this, a little introduction?
Yeah.
Before I might dive a little deeper, feel free to chime in.
Yeah, I mean, we could go, there's kind of a lot there. So just, you know, shut me up if I'm going on too long. But I do want to answer his first question that he had of how much should I have in each account? And my simplistic answer to that would be as much as you possibly can. So, you know, there you go. You can go ahead and take that with you and just build those accounts up as much as possible. That was a little bit of sarcasm there. But when it comes to projecting the retirement analysis, if we're going to make that assumption, we would also, of course, want to know, and again, using this assumption, he will have a decent idea, at least what he plans on spending in any given year. And we'll just kind of keep it at that for simplicity for right now. And if he's able to project those annual spending that him, I don't know if he's single or maybe with a spouse, is planning to do, as well as the counts, those three different tax style, always, never, and maybe taxable accounts that he's built up over time, and projecting those out, will be able to give him an idea of the feasibility of the account, you know, or the plan, for one, using, you know, reasonable return assumptions and inflation assumptions and all the assumptions that go into any sort of long-term projection. So all that being said, most, if not all, retirement planning software, you know, whether it's professional or even consumer facing, will use a distribution order that is often referred to as conventional wisdom. Why is it referred to conventional wisdom? My best guess is because that's been the typical order that everyone has used over time, with the goal being to somewhat delay taxes as you're withdrawing. So that conventional wisdom typical order would be, you would first withdraw from your, what we would call maybe taxable accounts. So that is your bank brokerage assets, where you may pay some taxes in terms of capital gains. You know, you're going to have investment income that you're paying taxes on most likely in a given year. But again, that will depend on the timing of the sales, how long you've held the assets, et cetera. We don't need to go deep in that rabbit hole right now. And that's what the software will assume using first. Once, and assuming, you know, you liquidate those over X amount of years, the next thing would be your always taxable assets. So in this listener's case, it would be that IRA and 401k. And then finally, if he or anyone were to eat through all those assets, they would save the Roth for last, because it's growing tax-free in the background over all this time. And then the distributions can come out tax-free. So we would, you know, try to project that out, and that would give us an estimate in each given year of what the potential taxes or taxes owed would look like in those years. And as Jim just mentioned, you know, we'd project that out over however many years the plan was, and we would get an idea of, you know, using this conventional wisdom strategy, which I will say is typically not the ultimate strategy that one would align on, but it's a starting point. And once we can see that tax picture kind of over this longer time frame, we can begin to develop a tax strategy to most benefit this client. And we would base that strategy, longtime listeners will know, on whatever this client's tax ordering number is. And for us, the way that we look at it in the firm is, who are we tax planning for? Because that's a critical question that we need to ask any client, or you out there, if you're thinking through your own plan, is who ultimately is this tax strategy for? Is it for, assuming if it's a couple, that's the two, are we tax planning for the two of us living together? Or potentially are we planning for the one or a survivor? So whether it's, you know, spouse A or spouse B, we want to make some proactive tax planning moves now in order to benefit that eventual situation. And then finally, the zero in the 210 would mean, are we tax planning for our heirs or whoever's going to inherit this money? But knowing who the client is tax planning for is paramount before we can give a very reasoned tax strategy. And then once that strategy is in place, knowing that it's going to change because tax laws are going to change, new amendments or clauses are going to come out that may change the way that some of this income is taxed, secure being one of those. Knowing that it's going to change, then on that annual basis, once we have the strategy, now we're kind of, we're closing the funnel and going down to the tactical execution of that tax strategy. That's where we can pull in actual income sources in a given year, project what your taxes will be if you were to pull money from maybe taxable or maybe always taxable or even some Roth. And that's where it comes into a really kind of an annual tax planning exercise built in with your, you know, everything else you're trying to accomplish that will lead into the actual contributions that come out based on your current needs and goals that I know we're going to dive into a little bit more here. So hopefully that was, you were able to follow that.
I followed it, but Chris, why don't you, if you could, you and I chatted about this very issue many, many times, and we came up with a concept that we call the liquidity account. Mm-hmm. Jacob will explain how we can design a liquidity account across all three account types, always taxable, maybe taxable, never mm-hmm. taxable. But I think this is the missing element that this gentleman has. Mm-hmm. He seems to think he needs to identify ahead of time which accounts specifically he's going to spend from each year throughout retirement based on this long-term tax projection, which is not how you can do things because taxes change constantly. Instead, we try to maintain a liquidity account, refill the liquidity account annually using a tax withdrawal strategy that Jake will explain. And Jacob, as being the investment person, his job is to design appropriate investments for the liquidity account, which he will get into. But before we can get into any of that, Chris, what is a liquidity account and what's the purpose behind it? The purpose is to solve what this man is having difficulty with.
Yeah, so he's bringing up an issue that people doing forward-looking planning faced and will continue to face all the time. And that is the desire to have things all planned out. So January, when the year starts, you know exactly where you're going to take the money from in the most tax efficient way. And so I will admit in the early years of planning, I kind of got sucked into that effort. Luckily, we discovered in the not too long after getting sucked into that very challenging way of looking at things, I realized there's probably a better way. And what I mean by a challenging way of doing things is that constantly you would think that you knew what was going to happen for the year. You would think you would know what income you might recognize or distributions you're going to need to make, because you had it all planned out in your spreadsheets and you had it all predicted and projected, only to find out when you got to the end of the year, things didn't turn out quite the way you had hoped. And oftentimes you would have done things a bit differently from a tax perspective had you known. And it dawned on me one day that, you know what, we don't need to predict this and try to determine each and every month of the year where you're going to take money out for your spending. Instead, let's just make sure that there's a pool of money that we can access that does not have any tax consequences. And the most straightforward, clean way of doing that is having a plain old bank account that is sitting there with cash in it that you have access to It's not in a retirement account, so there's no retirement account rules or taxation. It's available, fully liquid. Spend from that. And then every fall, when we do now have visibility on what's happened for the year, we know what income you have had, recognized maybe from consulting or a little part-time job you picked up in the summer or whatever, or other capital gains that have been maybe even forced upon you because you're invested in mutual funds that you don't have direct control over the transactions that are involved in that account. And those are the types of surprises that would come up over time. Well, we can wait and see how those surprises end up and then decide at the end of the year, because as long as by the end of the year we distribute from an IRA or do a conversion or other activities where we're consciously recognizing income on purpose, we can then refill the liquidity account in the most tax-efficient way and then start all over again in January. So essentially what we've done is push the decision of where we're going to get the money for any given year to the end of the year, where we know how the year has ended up, rather than at the beginning of the year where we're predicting how that tax year is going to go. That's all we've done. We've just shifted in time when you're forced to make the decision for that year's tactical decision for your tax strategy. And what I mean by that tactical word there is there's kind of a broad overlying long-term tax projection that leads to a tax strategy overall, but the tactical maneuvers that you make on a year-to-year basis are very specific and really need the visibility of what you can gain by waiting until the end of the year to make those tactical steps. And it's I think a fool's errand to try to make the tactical steps at the beginning of the year. Because unless you have a perfect crystal ball, you're going to make mistakes that could otherwise be avoided. So why not just push the decision to the end of the year? And that's accomplished by having a liquidity account. Now, it doesn't have to be in a plain old bank account. It can be in certain types of, you know, retirement accounts. A Roth, you know, has no tax consequences. But the key is have a pool of money that's accessible without tax consequences. So you can spend freely from it without worrying about making a mistake on the tax front. And then at the end of the year, you basically do a reconciliation and clean everything up. So that's what the liquidity account does and what we mean by the liquidity account.
Perfect. And before, Jacob, you start getting into positioning per se, let me just add a little bit of clarity before I hand it off to you. So Jake has done a good job trying to explain what we mean by there's long-term tax planning, which is what this gentleman was fixated on. How can he project all those multiple years out? We will use conventional wisdom in the office, folks, to project taxes, but that is specifically to create what Chris has termed the tax planning window. If we were to project, and you guys, you DIYers, follow our logic here. So Chris, when you do the programming, because you handle this part along with Keely and Jake in the office, you purposefully program our software to say, hey, client's going to spend maybe taxable assets first, correct?
I do, as the default. So the software, because it's so common, all planning software, including the stuff we use, will easily deploy what we call that conventional wisdom, where the non-qualified accounts, those maybe taxable accounts, are used first, then the traditional tax-deferred accounts, followed by the Roth. And we do that to get a view of opportunities to do it better. That's how I generally describe it to clients, is that what we're doing is we need to look at something as a starting point. May as well use conventional wisdom, really to point out why conventional wisdom is probably not the best way to go, and look for opportunities to do it differently to save some money on taxes or other tax side effects like IRMA or other related, you know, items.
Exactly. So, and this does play a role in positioning, folks, trust me. So once we can project spending to show person is going to spend maybe taxable assets first, followed by always taxable, followed by never taxable. That's not what we want to do, but it's a brilliant approach for doing what we want to ascertain. And what we want to ascertain is, are there any tax planning opportunities here? Could the client control their income? Now, again, some of you might retire right when RMDs begin. So you're going to be retiring at 73, 74, 75. Others will be retiring right when a pension begins. So there's going to be some income coming in for some of you, not all of you. But many of you are going to retire perhaps before you turn on Social Security, before you activate a pension, if you even have one. And you're going to be in a situation where you have some tax diversification. If you have little to no tax diversification, all your money is in always taxable accounts. And we see that sadly quite often, 80, 85, 90 plus percent of your money is in IRAs and 401ks. The analysis, this part of the analysis shows there might not be too big of a tax planning window, a tax planning opportunity. But once we can kind of figure out, do you have the ability to manipulate income? And if you wanted, control your income early in retirement. In other words, have the early you, the younger you, pay little to no taxes. Could you do that? That's what we're trying to find out. Conventional wisdom of spending from maybe taxable first can demonstrate that. Once we get an idea if there's a tax planning window, that tells us there could be some opportunity to do some tax planning. But a lot of it's truly going to depend on what a client actually spends throughout the year and what they actually earn. We have seen time and time again, we project one thing and the client does another. And in our approach to retirement planning, because for fun, we're not locking you into spending a certain percentage of your portfolio for a variety of reasons we shared with you why we just don't like that. We think that's the wrong way during your go-go years to limit spending on fun. We want to give you the fun number, your fun budget, and tell you to spend it as fast as you want during your go-go years. So we don't truly know, even with our projection. The client works with Chris and Jacob and Keeley, Jake and Keeley, to come up with a reasonable representation of what they might spend on fun. But we don't hold them to that. So we have found that the projections don't often match reality. And that's why we brought in the short-term tax planning. And that married perfectly with Chris's approach to the liquidity account, because he is right. For years, we tried to figure out how much a client was going to spend every year, try to give them a report saying, well, in this year, you're going to spend from this account, and this account, the following year, that account, and that account. And it didn't take us long at all to realize this is ridiculous. It's never going to work out this way. So many things change. And Chris came up with the concept of, wait a minute. Why don't we concentrate, and listener who asked this question, this is what you need to be doing. We have enough information in the retirement analysis to make some pretty accurate projections because we know their minimum dignity floor needs. We know whatever secure income they are going to turn on right away, Social Security, pension, or income annuity, or deferred comp for some people. So we know fairly close what they're going to be earning through these sources, if anything. We know what we think they're going to need in MDF. So we can get fairly accurate for the next couple of years. 1 to 2 years is the liquidity account. We can get fairly accurate on what they're going to need for MDF. Fun is a little more esoteric, if you will. I'm not quite sure if that's the right word, but Chris will correct me if I'm wrong. It's unique. It's fluid. It's open to interpretation. It's open to whatever the hell the client wants to do. But they do give us a pretty good idea of, hey, guys, I think it might look like this. And it gives us a dollar amount. Chris, if there's enough time, can explain. We're going to do probably three shows on this, how he helps people come up with an idea of what they might spend on fun. So we can get a fairly good idea, perhaps, for fun, what they might spend over the next 1 or 2 years. Once we know that, that becomes your liquidity need. Liquidity, in my view, as Chris rightly pointed out, isn't just how quickly you can turn something into literal cash in hand. It's turning something into literal cash in hand without tax implications. That does not mean we won't maintain some liquidity inside an IRA, liquidity from the traditional sense that is available to turn into cash very quickly without any implications based on market performance. Inside an IRA, there's still going to be taxes, but we do like some liquidity in IRAs as well. But the idea is to have 1 to 2 years of these cash needs in a bank account, or, as Chris rightly pointed out, a Roth IRA, or, as Jacob would probably pick up on, a brokerage account if it's invested in a reasonable principal protected holding. We generally use a 1 to 3 month laddered T-bill. But that can quickly be turned into cash with minimal tax implications as well. Or a money market fund. Most of you DIYers understand money market mutual funds. Many of you probably own the Vanguard one. So you can quickly turn a money market, a high yield bank account inside a brokerage. You can, there's any number of things inside a brokerage account as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be money in the bank. But Chris is correct. In a perfect world, it would be sitting right in your checking account, but it doesn't have to be. The idea is not to try to guess on day one where each investment position should be, what account it should be in. Jacob's going to explain how he walks clients through this. Trust me, he will. I'm just trying to set a stage and get you guys to understand conceptually what Jake is doing from a tax perspective and what Chris and his team does from a planning perspective and what you guys need to do as a DIYer perspective. Figure out what your cash needs are for a year or two. You're going to replenish that every year with a tax analysis every fall. That's the next phase. Chris is correct when he says, we're going to help, or you as a DIYer will determine what accounts are going to be spent from, but you're not going to make that determination until November or December. In January, your liquidity account should be full. Our clients vacillate if they can create a liquidity account. They vacillate back and forth between 1 and 2 years of liquidity. You're going to choose whatever works for you. We're fine with 1 year because we're going to replenish it in November or December. And the reason we do the calculation, as Jake pointed out, in November and December, you already know 11, maybe 10 to 11 months of a 12-month year, what you earned so far. Remember, if you are debiting all of your minimum dignity floor needs and all of your fund needs from an account with no tax implications, you yourself with your spending have created no tax issue. Now, your liquidity account might have earned some interest, but you will have known by November, December, nearly all of the interest you've earned. You would have known if you had any mutual fund distributions from a brokerage account, any part-time income because you did some consulting, gambling winnings if you went to Vegas. You will have known nearly all. The only month you probably have to project is December or maybe November and December. But you have 10 or 11 of the 12 months known. So in other words, you can get fairly accurate of what your income for that year is going to be. Now, if you own a lot of mutual funds in brokerage accounts and they traditionally pay out income, very sporadic income, you may want to wait until December and the mutual fund announces what the distribution for the year is going to be. Some distributions can be quite substantial. We'll concede that $30,000, $40,000, $50,000+. We've seen it. So you kind of have to, if you fall into that category, wait for the mutual fund company to give you that estimate. But they're getting better and better at that, folks. And I'm seeing the numbers coming out even in November that are fairly accurate of what the distribution in December is going to be. So the point is, listener who asked this question, and all of you do-it-yourselfers, don't overthink this. You guys are VGs, you're engineers, you by nature overthink it. Don't. Try to design a liquidity account. And if you truly are 2, 3, 4, 5 years from retirement, it gives you time to start getting that money in a bank or in a Roth or in a brokerage account. Get it liquid where you can turn it into cash with little to no tax implication. That's the key. And you just spend from your heart's content. Even with positionings, because Jacob's going to share with you a Jell-O analogy in a minute. Get ready, Jacob. I'm going to be handing this to you. You can see, and you're going to be doing most of the talking next. But what I want the listeners to understand is the brilliance of the liquidity account when Chris came up with this. Just wait a minute. We're way overthinking this. And that's typical for us. We're planners. Let's simplify this. We cannot project. We've had people ask us this. I thought you were going to tell us what I had to spend from this year, next year, the year after, the year after, the year after, the year after. Where's this projection? How can we tell you when Congress changes the tax laws seemingly every other freaking year? They come out with some new tax rule. Or you might spend much more one year than you ever projected, or significantly less than you ever thought another year. Or you get this inheritance that has a full step up in basis, and you don't have to take any distributions for 10 years. So much changes, and we realized we can't project that. We can project conventional wisdom to see if there's a tax planning window, because that tax planning window will help us as we refill this liquidity account. But instead, we need people to concentrate on creating this liquidity account and refilling it. Now, this is not an exercise you have to do forever, folks. We firmly believe as a company that you will have to probably do this up to and maybe through a couple of years after your RMDs. But eventually your retirement's going to get to the point where your go-go phase is over, your minimum dignity floor delay period is over, you have entered the post-delay period, you are hopefully covering your minimum dignity floor shortage with lifetime guaranteed secure income. So you have RMDs, you have lifetime guaranteed secure income, you might have Social Security turned on, pension turned on, you're not spending as much on fun anymore, there may not be much more need to do this diligent planning. This truly is going to be something, though, that will impact you during the go-go phase of retirement and probably up to and maybe a couple of years for some of you after RMDs. Now, this is a bell curve. Most of you will be in that range. Some it'll happen much sooner. Some it'll happen much later. But this isn't an effort that you're going to have to do forever. Now, that the liquidity account idea is set, this gentleman's saying, hey, that's fine. I never thought of that. Great, Jim. But how the hell is that going to help me understand what account each position goes in? Well, Jacob's going to share with you that as a firm, we have a couple of tried and true, for lack of a better term, Jacob, accounts that certain positions will always be initially invested in. But what Jacob goes to great lengths to get positioning clients to understand is what I call Jell-O. And Jacob, why don't you take over from there and pretend you're talking to someone new as you would? Yeah. And what would you be watching? Not that the liquidity is taken care of. You don't have to explain any of that. Right. How are you going to get them to understand? I'm going to be putting your positions in these accounts, but they're etched in jello.
Right, right. And so, yeah, I mean, conceptually, right, there's a lot to kind of consider here. And it's especially when you are, you know, a VG or an engineer type or a planner type, right? It's really easy for us to sit here and try and kind of iron this out and lay it all out and say, hey, you know, I'm 2 years from retirement. I'm trying to set up some of this initial kind of positioning. I want to build as much structure into this as I possibly can. And I totally understand kind of that thought process. And we ourselves, you know, fall into that kind of bin of trying to, you know, kind of build as much structure into these plans as we possibly can. But like Jim is kind of constantly referring to here, and as we kind of constantly talk about, you know, when we're initially kind of structuring a positioning plan and we're starting to kind of iron out some of these reserves and say, okay, you know, which style of taxable account do we want to earmark for something like the aging and the buffer reserve? Which style do we want to earmark for? You know, maybe there's a long-term minimum dignity floor shortage, something like that. You know, there are a couple of starting points that we tend to kind of lean on as we're building the structure into these plans. But you know, it's not as though that you're going to be stuck with the initial kind of structure, right? We have to start somewhere, but we also have to acknowledge that things are going to change in retirement, right? Taxes are going to change. And so what Jim's kind of referring to with the jello concept is really the idea that we would encourage everybody to not be dogmatic, right? Let's say you start with a specific reserve. Let me pick on the long-term minimum dignity floor shortage as just kind of an example here, and I'll explain why in a second. Well, let's pick on that reserve specifically. And let's say this gentleman, he's got a long-term minimum dignity floor shortage. He sets aside
I hate to interrupt. You're doing excellent. Yeah. Just explain what long-term minimum dignity floor shortage is for those who don't quite understand, then continue.
Sure. Yeah. Long-term minimum dignity floor shortage, right? That's the period of time after your secure income has been projected to kind of fully kick on, right? So the delay period minimum dignity floor, that's from retirement through, you know, usually for most folks, right, it's when your Social Security is projected to fully kick on. The long-term minimum dignity floor is kind of from that standpoint onward. So your Social Security is now fully kicked on, and you're looking at any shortage that might accrue over the long run in retirement. Usually for most folks, and you know, it obviously kind of depends. I would say this comes sometime in kind of the, you know, early to mid to late kind of 70s, right? Depends all on when somebody's claiming Social Security. If they have Social Security, maybe they have a pension, right? But typically somewhere in kind of that time period, 70s to kind of 80s or so. And so the long-term minimum dignity floor from an investment standpoint and a tax kind of planning standpoint, that's one of those reserves where when we're initially kind of sitting down, we're trying to kind of build some of this structure into a positioning plan. One of the kind of, you know, initial thoughts running through our heads would be, hey, under kind of, you know, the recent changes with Secure 2 and the benefits of, you know, the ability for excess annuity payments to offset, you know, any RMD, you know, anticipated RMD needs that a client may have. A lot of the times when we're looking at positioning something like the long-term minimum dignity floor, I don't know how deep you want me to get into the weeds, Jim, on the calculation for that reserve. But a lot of the times when we're looking at, hey, how much in today's dollars do we want to set aside to, you know, cover that projected long-term minimum dignity floor set aside, the number that we kind of use for that set aside in today's dollars is all based off, you know, what an annuity would cost this client in the future when that shortage is anticipated to start kind of accruing there. And that's not
Jacob,
to say
we covered that a lot. So let's just use, yeah. And Chris, I think a reasonable number that we often see is maybe $400,000 or $500,000. Would you guys be okay if Jacob just uses something like that?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Jake, let's just assume they have to put $500,000 into their long-term minimum dignity floor need of that position
set
that
aside.
You're talking
yeah.
about.
Sure. Sure. Yep. So let's say the client has the $500,000 kind of long-term MDF shortage there. What we would kind of typically do when we're starting the structure of this plan is earmark a specific style of account. And usually that would be a pre-tax or always taxable style of account, like an IRA. The thought process there being, again, hey, we don't know exactly when this shortage is actually going to occur. We don't know whether the client is actually going to end up buying that annuity, right, to cover that remaining kind of shortage with lifetime guaranteed secure income. But we need to kind of set some dollars aside as a starting point. And the reason we like to kind of start with earmarking an IRA for a reserve like that has to do with kind of the secure two rules that I mentioned of saying, hey, you know, theoretically, if this client does eventually kind of annuitize, you know, it might actually be best for the annuity to happen in an IRA, an always taxable style of an account, because they might actually be able to benefit from, you know, secure two and those excess kind of annuity payments actually offsetting some of their RMD needs in the future. So it's giving us at least kind of a starting point, right? And we're starting to build structure into the plan, but it's not necessarily saying, hey, because we're setting these dollars aside in an IRA right now, that's not necessarily, you know, pigeonholing you into saying, okay, well, I can't make any changes in the future, or this money has to be earmarked in the IRA because I'm going to maybe annuitize it in the future. Like Jim was kind of saying with the concept of Jell-O, right? We're always kind of trying to reinforce the concept that as we build some of these positioning plans, and as you, the listener, start to kind of maybe structure some of this yourself, everything you're structuring, I would consider it to be kind of etched in Jell-O rather than stone, right? Meaning that as things kind of change in retirement, as tax laws change, you know, some of these reserves that we might set up kind of initially when we're building some structure into the plan are definitely going to change 5, 6, 7, 10 years into retirement, right? Depending on what all kind of happens. So although we might kind of typically sit here and say, hey, you know, something like the long-term minimum dignity floor, we like to kind of start by earmarking that in an always taxable kind of IRA style of account. By no means are we saying that we're going to, you know, stick to that and force that to kind of be the case throughout the remainder of retirement. It's Jell-O, right? If things change and that no longer kind of makes sense, we might actually switch some of the positions around. We're not going to be dogmatic in saying, hey, the $500,000 we initially kind of set aside for long-term MDF, that can only be used for the long-term MDF. Maybe a tax law changes and it actually makes sense for the client to look at using a Roth style of account for purchasing an annuity, or maybe they don't decide to annuitize at all and they want to cover the shortage with assets. And it makes sense to start doing some of that capital gain recognition and take it from a brokerage account. So there are a couple of positions that we like to kind of have some of that structure initially, and we lean on kind of earmarking for some of these reserves. Another good example, which I don't get too into the weeds on because I know I'm already kind of rambling on it, is something like the aging reserve, right? Aging in kind of the long-term care set aside. That's another one where, again, kind of our initial thought process would be, hey, that's money that hopefully, you know, is never needed, right? But if it is, it's not until, you know, you're typically your 80s, mid 80s timeframe. Now, obviously something could happen, you know, ahead of that. But when we're initially kind of structuring this, that's kind of the timeline that we have in the back of our heads. And we kind of like to earmark, you know, again, pre-tax, always taxable IRA style of accounts for a reserve like the aging or the long-term care. Because, you know, heaven forbid, something should happen from an aging standpoint and you did have to tap into that specific kind of set aside, there are some potential kind of tax benefits to, you know, qualified distributions for aging events that could come out of the IRA style of account. So again, it's acting as a starting point where there's some thought kind of behind the scenes of saying, hey, you know, there are situations that could come up where it makes sense to have these earmarked in, you know, an IRA or an always taxable account. We're certainly not sitting here saying that that's always going to kind of be the case, but at least it helps you to kind of give some structure initially as you start to say, hey, you know, I'm 2 years from retirement. I want to start kind of, you know, trying to position some of these accounts. I'm getting a little bit maybe overwhelmed with, you know, the tax implications of everything. What, you know, Chris and I were talking before this, and what I would kind of maybe encourage this listener to do is look at some of those more, you know, some of those reserves that I just kind of talked about, you know, the long-term MDF, aging and long-term care, even like a guaranteed inheritance, right? Obviously, I don't know whether that's a priority for this gentleman or not, but if it was, that's another reserve where, you know, generally we're going to say, hey, if it's guaranteed inheritance, right, this is money that, you know, hopefully not inherited for a long time. It's got a long time to kind of grow. Typically, the best kind of accounts to inherit are obviously Roth style of accounts where they're inherited kind of tax-free. The second best style would be something like a trust or a brokerage account, right? Where at least based on current legislation, you know, they might be able to benefit from kind of a step up in the cost basis. So there are a couple of positions as you start to structure this, where I think you could sit down and say, hey, okay, you know, I can kind of reasonably estimate an IRA being earmarked for aging and long-term MDF. If an inheritance is important, I can reasonably kind of maybe earmark a portion of the Roth or the brokerage style of account for that reserve. And it at least helps to hopefully give this listener a little bit of kind of structure to where they're starting to put some of these puzzle pieces in place. Of course, always acknowledging, right, that things could easily change, right? You could easily end up moving some of the IRA money that you originally earmarked for long-term MDF into a different, you know, set aside. Maybe it makes sense to move that into a fund spending, right? Or something like that. So those are just a couple of the items that, you know, I would say we kind of look at when we're initially kind of building some structure into the plan, but definitely, you know, take it with a grain of salt and keep in mind that Jell-O concept, right? That Jim's talking about, where as easy as it is for us to all kind of fall into the shoes of saying, hey, you know, this is my long-term MDF. It's going to cover, you know, this specific position for the remainder of my retirement. Don't pigeonhole yourself into the thinking that way. It openly acknowledge that things are going to change. And if it makes sense to take, you know, money from a Roth rather than the IRA that you had initially earmarked for that specific reserve, that's totally fine. That's normal. That's real life, right? That's real kind of retirement and what's going to happen. So hopefully that is kind of what you were getting at, Jim, and provides a little bit of at least a jumping off point for maybe where this listener can kind of look at some of the accounts we typically earmark for some of these reserves.
Oh, it does. And before I set up for a handoff to Jake, Chris, is there anything you want to add?
No, I think Jacob had a good point that I think some of the long-term dedicated reserves that have an established goal or task in their lives, if you will, the money that you're dedicating to specific long-term purposes, those are probably the easiest to initially position. But don't think it's all that same way. There's some of these early transactional times, like the early go-go period where the distributions might be really heavy, takes a little bit different take on it. And so I think people can get overwhelmed, which I think when we get these questions from listeners, it's clear that they are acknowledging, oh my gosh, this is just really complicated and overwhelming. They're trying to consider it all simultaneously. So I think carving off some of the obvious long-term positions and getting those established will help narrow then your task so that you can concentrate on some of the more dynamic things in the short term.
I like that. And what I want people to understand is a couple of the concepts that Jacob was discussing. And to also acknowledge, some of you don't have good tax diversification. And if 90, 95% of your money is in always taxable accounts, pretty much all your positions are going to be in always taxable accounts. This issue that the gentleman wrote about really only applies to people who have some degree of tax diversification, whether it's across all three style accounts, always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable, or only two, an always and a never, or an always and a maybe. That's where making some of these broad-based initial positions come into play. The SECURE Act has changed everything. And we start to look at long-term MDF reserves inside traditional IRAs. Because the excess, we have to assume the person's going to annuitize, but they may not. The older you is going to make that decision, not the younger you. But if the older you does decide to annuitize, it would likely make sense for them to annuitize inside an IRA, because as we all know, you get much more money out of an annuitized annuity than you would off of earnings from an investment because of mortality credits. So all that excess can offset RMDs from your non-annuitized IRAs. So that's why we default to that. guaranteed inheritances, or people who are prioritizing the zero in the tax ordering number that Jake spoke about. If people are doing some conversions early in retirement to get money into a Roth to leave to a beneficiary, assuming that beneficiary is not a special needs beneficiary, and this money must be there with no principal fluctuation risk at all, most people would like their Roth money invested based on the age of the beneficiary who's going to be inheriting it, especially, again, post-secure. That Roth can sit there for 10 years before it has to be closed, growing tax-free, allowing ample opportunity for sequence of return risk, if you will, you dying and the child inheriting the Roth just in the middle of a market downturn, gives ample opportunity for that child should they desire to wait for the market to recover, and hopefully they will, and even if they didn't, if they retired with it up, hopefully they're not going to close it right away and they're going to realize this huge benefit of allowing this account to grow for 10 years and then close it tax-free. So we tend to default to Roth IRAs for a guaranteed inheritance. Or again, if we're doing the zero priority and this money is now in a Roth, assuming it's not going to be earmarked for any other position, we call that non-positioned assets. Assuming it's not tied to anything else, and it may very well be inherited if it's not needed, we would invest it more aggressively inside the Roth. But you will have some other situations where you might have just a little bit of money available in a Roth and a little bit in a brokerage and an IRA. So that came up with the concept of etched in jello, not in stone. And this is something I bet most of you DIYers and this particular listener are missing the boat on. Don't be dogmatic. Jacob tries to go to great lengths to let our clients know, we've got you positioned this way. We have this position in this account. Here's why. This position in this account. Here's why. This position in this account. And by account, I mean tax qualification of account. Always taxable, maybe taxable, never taxable. But it could happen. You suffer a stroke like I did. You did not recover gracefully like I did, thankfully. And now, in a heartbeat, no pun intended, you're paralyzed or partially paralyzed. And all of a sudden, overnight, boom, you need long-term care reserve. You need that money. And we have to start taking it out. Something has happened and we need it. Or more practical one, more cheerful one. Maybe I should have led with this one. You decide out of the blue to buy a $100,000 Lamborghini. Never saw it coming. But you figure, screw it. I got the cash. Oh, I got the money. I got the ability. I got the assets. I fell in love. I'm buying a Lamborghini. Jim, I never told you that I was going to buy a $100,000 Lamborghini. I told you that I needed $50,000 for fun. And that's how you've created this reserve. I need $100,000. If Jacob got that call, the first thing he's going to do is probably ask for a photo and a ride. But outside of that, he's probably going to get a hold of Jake. And he's going to say, hey, Jake, I've got a gentleman who wants a $100,000 Lamborghini. You don't know what account to take the money from. He's not going to look at where these positions are. If he only had $50,000 of liquid cash available, he's now going to take it from an IRA or brokerage account or Roth or whatever accounts this gentleman has. But the first thing he's going to do is call a tax planner, most likely Jake, possibly Paul. And what they're going to do is they're going to start trying to get some projections. What is last year's tax return? Let's look at that. What is their income year to date? Now, this could happen in January, which is going to be hard to project. Well, easy, how much they made in January, but hard to project what they're going to earn for the next 11 months. But if this is happening in June or October or November, it's going to be a hell of a lot easier for them. But they're going to look and see. And they might say, hey, goodness, no. We cannot take this from an IRA at all. And inside the brokerage account, they only have short-term gains. I don't know, I'm making this up. You got to take this from the Roth. Jacob, if the Roth had no reserve earmarked specifically for fun, are you going to tell Jake or Paul, nope, can't do it. Their Roth does not have any designated fund spending?
No, definitely not.
Because positions, folks, are etched in jello. What Jacob will do is say, okay, well, the Roth is really assets earmarked for an inheritance. Fortunately, and let's just say in my example, the market is up. So sequence of return risk, no issue. He's selling something that's up. No problem. And let's say Jake said, we got to take all $100,000 from a Roth. They cannot realize any additional income. Jake Ub will simply sell $100,000 of a different position and distribute the money. Because here, short term, we are much more concerned with taxation than the long term individual positions. But he will note, not mentally, he will jot this down in his software, that $100,000 of guaranteed, or what we hope was inheritance, needs to be assigned from a different position at an appropriate time. Let me get a better way of explaining that. Let's just say Jake told Jacob, take this from the brokerage account and take it from long-term cap gains. The guy's going to be fine. But there are no long-term cap gains. What if it's all, excuse me, the other way around. Jake said, take it from the brokerage account, but don't generate any income. Take it all from losses. What if there were no losses? Well, Jacob may turn around and take it from the Roth and make a note, we've got to replace that. It doesn't have to be replaced inside the Roth. In this particular case, in his software, explain, Jacob, the software that you use. Before I hand it, I am going to hand it to you, Jake, to talk about short-term tax planning and what you actually look at. But yes. Jacob, explain how, and you all don't have access to software like this, but you have access to Excel. How you would simply in the software say, hey, I'm going to make some moves. I'm going to take $100,000 from a Roth and distribute it for the Lamborghini, and I'm going to assign $100,000 of an asset that has grown in value. Jake told me I can't sell and realize a capital gain, and there's not enough losses to do this. But I'm going to assign now $100,000 of this money that might have been for a different position. I'm going to assign it for the inheritance that I just took from the Roth. Follow what I'm trying to explain, folks. This sounds complicated. First of all, it doesn't happen nearly as often as you think. But when it does happen, Jacob can make this change in his software. It's not realizing any gains. He's just programming software differently. You can make this in your spreadsheet. Jacob, explain what I just described.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's really just kind of a matter, right, of retitling, if you will, which dollars are earmarked for kind of what reserve. So assuming that we sent out this Roth money because we couldn't realize any capital gains, I would obviously go into our software and kind of acknowledge, hey, we sent this money out of the Roth. We need to refill this with other dollars, right? Maybe by moving, earmarking a different kind of position. Jim's been picking on the brokerage account in this example. So I might go into our software and say, hey, maybe they have an individual stock holding right in their brokerage account. I'll just pick on, Microsoft, not for one reason or another, but just because it's a commonly held stock holding. Let's say they had Microsoft right in their brokerage account that was originally earmarked for something else. Maybe it was originally earmarked for buffer reserve or an inheritance, something like that. Well, acknowledging that we've sent some of the liquidity and the money out of the Roth for this Lamborghini, I might go into that brokerage account and say, hey, Microsoft the dollar amount's pretty similar to maybe what the $100,000 that we sent out for this Lamborghini in this example. I might kind of reassign that, if you will, or kind of retitle that Microsoft holding from its original kind of purpose or positioning of inheritance in this case, in this example, to, you know, what the Roth dollars were originally kind of earmarked for. It's really just a kind of a matter of, you know, retitling or repurposing these different kind of investments and just acknowledging that, right, you know, just because dollars were originally earmarked for one specific need, if they were distributed or needed to be sent out for another need, right, we can look at the overall kind of positions and try to refill the money that we sent out from other accounts, other dollars that were earmarked for different positions in a way that kind of makes the most sense. It's really just kind of harping on, again, not being dogmatic. We're not going to say, hey, you know, George can't go buy this Lamborghini because we didn't have any liquidity earmarked in the Roth, right? We're going to make it work. We're going to send that money out if it makes sense from the tax perspective to kind of do so, right? And if that's the recommendation. And now it becomes a matter of, which assets do we want to refill that sent out money with that are kind of an applicable kind of replacement, if you will. And so we would try and kind of do that on our software and in our notes as well.
Exactly. And what we may also do, let's again, because most of you have your money in always taxable accounts. And if Jake said, hey, they can't realize $100,000 from their IRA, they can't do it, it's just going to push them in a high tax bracket. You got to distribute it from the Roth. Jake Ub is not going to tell the client or Jake, nope, can't do it. The Roth is earmarked towards inheritance. A Lamborghini is not an inheritance. They can't get the money. That's just silly. You know you're not going to do that, folks. What Jake Ub and Jake will do is Jake Ub will distribute from the inheritance the $100,000. Jake will note, okay, in a perfect world, over the coming years, with our annual withdrawal analysis, I'm going to see if there's ever opportunity to start converting $100,000 inside the IRA back into the Roth, if the client agrees to this, to get that inheritance back into the Roth. If the client wants it back in and is willing to do the conversions in a tax-efficient manner. So there's any number of scenarios where this can happen. Just don't think anybody is clairvoyant enough and software is so perfect. It is a crystal ball and can tell you exactly what's going to happen for the rest of your life, how much you should spend every year, and exactly what accounts it should come from. You cannot do that. You're going to assign the positions in the most reasonable manner possible based on what you know the day you're putting the positioning plan in place and based on the tax rules as they exist at that time. And you're going to adjust this plan every single year, if need be, to reflect what actually happens to you. Because let me tell you, folks, when I used to deliver plans, and Jake, I don't know if you say this when you deliver plans anymore, I would lead with everything I'm about to go over with you is wrong. And I would explain to people it's wrong because we cannot predict the future. But the reason we still believe passionately in doing a retirement analysis is the law of large numbers. We feel very confident that all the data sets that we are analyzing, the hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands, of different calculations and projections are fairly accurate. Maybe not so much for the next 30 years, but definitely fairly accurate today to give us an idea of what the trends are showing. We may not be able to nail to the T exactly what you're going to be paying on a cell phone bill 25 years from now, if cell phones even exist. But we will have a fairly accurate expense tied to phone communication that we know is always going to be needed to one degree or another. So that number is fairly accurate, even though it's not exact. The trends that data points show is fairly accurate. Each individual number itself is probably terribly inaccurate, but collectively they're very accurate. So that's why we feel comfortable with a retirement plan. And it's the same thing. We feel fairly comfortable with these broad-based positioning decisions. But Jake, before you wrap up and Chris ends the show, quickly try to explain what the annual withdrawal analysis, what everybody, and if you do your own taxes, you can figure this out yourself. If you use someone, hopefully they can figure it out for you. But what is it you're trying to do, and how is it done? Just get them to understand. That's the last missing piece. I don't quite know if they understand this. This annual withdrawal every November, December, because you know all the income, or at least most of the income. What are you next doing with it? How we kind of look at expending from next year, what we're projecting. Should we pull any of it into this year? Should we delay any remaining distributions from this year into next year? Yeah. Those types of things. What are you looking at?
Sure. Yeah. So I'll do my best to summarize this. So, you know, it'll start at least on our end, and, you know, would recommend this to you all as well. It should fit into your overall tax strategy, like Chris mentioned. And now this comes down to the tactical deployment. So I would first want to understand, you know, what if any spending needs are we trying to, you know, how much of that liquidity account do we need to replenish, if at all, from, you know, the positioning side. And then what I'm going to do is, you know, start a conversation and gather some data from the client on any income sources that they have for the year. I mean, I want, you know, brokerage statements. You know, if I can get, you know, through the end of October or through the end of September or even October, you know, that's 9 or 10 months worth of income earned for the year from, you know, dividends from a brokerage account, which were qualified, which were ordinary, which of those dividends may be tax exempt on the state level if they're coming from, you know, federal government obligations like money markets or certain bonds. I want to know, you know, if they're on Social Security, you know, Social Security paid in, if obviously if they're earning any income, whether W-2, 1099 or otherwise, all the other things like Jim mentioned before, do they have any rental properties? You know, I'm just thinking of all the different schedules that would be on a tax return, interest, and then any capital gains realized. Were there any capital loss carryforwards from a prior year? So all of those things. I'm basically trying to paint a picture. I'm trying to visualize using some cool software of what is that tax return going to look like, you know, when it comes to the next March or April when it's actually time to file. And try to get as accurate as possible on what that income is going to look like. And then based on that, we can have a conversation. I'm saying, you know, myself or one of the tax planners with the client as to, you know, your overall tax strategy says it's going to make the most sense. I'll just make up an example, you know, to convert as much as you can to the top of the 22% marginal tax bracket. Well, as you can, you know, see here, based on income from all sources and what we project through the end of the year, that you are going to be $80,000 short of that bracket. I'll just use that as an example. Now, depending on their overall tax diversification, it may be very straightforward. Let's convert to Roth. You know, maybe this is back to our Lamborghini example, and we'll be able to put $80,000 converted from the IRA back into the Roth. We probably wouldn't, you know, if it's a marginal tax bracket that we're targeting, you know, I'm a little less concerned with being super precise because, you know, if we go over by $100, well, you pay $100 at 24%. Where I would be more precise is if we're targeting a specific IRMA threshold, and longtime listeners will understand this because if you go $1 over an IRMA threshold, you do trigger that increase in your Medicare premiums 2 years following for that entire year. So I'll be a little bit more conservative, and maybe instead of 80,000, maybe let's just do 75, just to give ourselves a little wiggle room. Maybe, you know, a mutual fund that's in your brokerage account ends up paying a capital gain that's slightly higher than the estimates that they showed on their website, which can happen. Just give ourselves a little bit of breathing room. And so once we can, you know, outline all that, put the projection together, and maybe even we look at a couple of different scenarios. Maybe we're looking at the tax implications in a given year of converting to Roth or just distributing from the IRA if the money's needed, you know, in the near term, versus, hey, what happened, you know, our brokerage account's up a lot. Would this be a good time to do some capital gain harvesting and utilize some of the, you know, this quote unquote lower tax bracket to pull some of those capital gains forward now? And, you know, we can kind of do a compare and contrast on what makes the most sense for their situation. And then finally on that, well, there's going to be some taxes due, obviously, as a result of these proactive tax planning moves. But instead of, you know, punting the can down the road, which is what conventional wisdom would usually say, and let's go ahead and just keep our income and our tax situation low this year, I'll let 5 years from now me deal with those taxes. You know, let's go ahead and take advantage of some of these quote unquote lower brackets this year or next year, whenever you're doing this, realize some income, have a plan for paying the taxes due on that income, and then, you know, continue on with your life. So that's what we try to help clients with in a given year, is that kind of tactical deployment of their overall tax strategy. And just, hey, we want to take this trip. We want to do this remodel. We want to give some money to whoever, you know, free up the money for them to do that for the following year.
Perfect.
Yeah. So good Chris, example that things are kind of dynamic and have to be monitored, and particularly during the earlier years of retirement, that's where a lot of this activity is going on. Most of the time later on, when you settle into kind of a steady state and the distribution amounts aren't as large because all of your secure income is turned on and your desired spending has reduced a bit as you transition into the slow go phase and beyond. It's not as complicated as this might sound forever. But it's particular, you know, it's pretty much what these guys are describing in the early years. There's a lot to do. That's when you've got most of the money that's moving around because you haven't spent it yet. There's large distributions likely because it's a period where you've got intentions to do expensive things in the go-go period, and your secure income may not be fully turned on yet, as you're maybe delaying your Social Security or your pension doesn't turn on until later, things like that. And, but things do settle down over time. Once you get some of these things done, we find that after we do updates for people, after a while, some of the longer term reserves and positions are just kind of monitored. They're just doing their thing in the background. And then it's, you know, some of this, yearly activity that Jake just, walked everybody through. So it's, takes a fair amount of work. It's got to be a serious hobby for you if that's something you're taking on your own. Or hopefully if you're working with an advisor, they can help you with this and they've got their fingers really deep into the tax story. We try our best to look at all this stuff in enough detail that we can improve people's financial situations. And it's never going to be precise. You're never going to nail it perfectly. That's just the nature of retirement planning and financial planning in general. But I think you can move the needle in your favor if you pay attention to a lot of these things. So, as Jim mentioned, we'll be back kind of a continuation of some related topics on this. So at least over the next one or two EDU shows. So we'll dive into that. Another listener email will be coming up talking specifically about positioning in the transition period. But we appreciate you listening. And if you've got any feedback or want to add to this discussion we're having, make sure you shoot Jim an email. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address, and indicate that it's a comment or question for the podcast. And we can probably fold in a little bit of dialogue as we go through this topic here over the next couple of shows. So appreciate all three J's joining me today, and all you listeners take care. And we'll be with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement.
Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.